Vampires have apparently not used up their 15 minutes. Best-selling novelist Stephen King just announced that vampires will be the new challenge for his hero in the upcoming sequel to his classic The Shining. HBO's True Blood was one of the summer's TV hits, and excitement is building over the November opening of Breaking Dawn Part 1, the latest installment in the Twilight saga based, of course, on Stephanie Meyer's books.
I, Edward Cullen, take you, Bella Swan.
For better or for worse.
To love.
To cherish. As long as we both shall live.
Yes, Edward the Vampire and his lady love Bella will finally have a wedding night after what could be the longest tease in movie history. All of this will be discussed in Harvard Extension School lecturer Sue Weaver Shopp's course, The Vampire in Literature and Film, which has 80 online students this semester. We spoke to Sue Shopp last year and found that her background in 19th century poetry and fiction gave her the starting point for this course.
I was familiar with Bram Stoker's Dracula and Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, and of course I knew about Samuel Taylor Coleridge's wonderful poem Christabel, but I really wasn't familiar with most 20th century and certainly no 21st century vampire literature. And when I began my investigation into all of this, I was stunned to learn that there are over 1,100 vampire novels and short stories and about 300 or 400 movies that have been made on this subject. So obviously there really is a long historical interest in the vampire figure.
Well, you just gave us a hint of that, you know, because you mentioned Bram Stoker's Dracula, the 1897 novel, but as you were just ticking off, there were other works even before that.
Yes. The first one was Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, Christabel, which features a female vampire who comes and vampirizes a young woman. And they're very interesting homoerotic overtones, lesbian overtones to the whole story. After that came John Polidori's very short novel called The Vampire, based on a fragment that he took from Lord Byron.
And that's in 1819.
That's in 1819. And the interesting thing about that, of course, is that that was written somewhat under the influence of a poem that Byron had earlier written called The Giaour, in which one of the early descriptions of the vampire appears as well. Following that was Sheridan Le Fanu's story, Carmilla, the lesbian vampire story from 1872.
Well, and we understand that all of these were born out of Eastern European legend, mythology that was on the ground.
Correct. There were medical accounts, philosophical accounts, theological accounts, based on the ostensible existence, the real existence of vampires. There were reports from all sorts of eyewitnesses across Eastern Europe, Russia, Bosnia, Serbia, all of which supposedly recounted real-life adventures with or encounters with vampires. And people were beginning to write philosophical treatises about this, medical treatises, trying to understand what the vampire phenomenon was all about.
And what did they think it was? I mean, who did they think these people were, if in fact there were people that were somehow being seen as vampires?
Well, it comes from a very interesting conflation of circumstances. Most anthropologists now believe it came from a lack of understanding about the nature of death. People really didn't understand about the decomposition of the body. People also didn't understand about disease. A lot of diseases, the plague, things like this spread at different times. And suddenly, whole groups of people would be wiped out. And because people lacked scientific or medical understanding of things like this, very often a superstitious explanation is the one that was provided for things like this. Many people have said that excommunication from the church was also something that fed into the hysteria about vampires, because people believed that if you had been excommunicated, you were damned, you were going to hell, and that in fact those people who had been excommunicated, they might well come back from the dead and haunt the living because they were damned souls. So you have this very interesting combination of medical, scientific superstition and also theological uncertainty and fear that feed into this.
Well, and then as we go through the years, you've studied how the vampire myth has changed and reflected the times. I mean, it seems to have one constant, that the the vampire is the other.
It's probably one of the most elastic, flexible, metaphorical figures in all of literature, and certainly it's been used that way in film. The vampire does represent outsiderness, and it's been embraced by the homosexual community simply because this is such an apt metaphor for the way in which we treat people who practice alternative lifestyles, people who do not appear to be conforming to social norms and so on. So again, the vampire has been used as a figure not just to describe homosexuality or to represent homosexuality, but to represent really any kind of otherness. Oftentimes, racial metaphors are linked to vampirism.
Well, I'm thinking, too, you know, the wildly popular Twilight series from Stephanie Meyer, she's a Mormon.
Yes.
And in this case, one of the vampires is the other because he chooses abstinence, which isn't as popular among young people today. That makes him an other.
It does, and one can be an other within one's own other community as well. It's a very interesting thing. The novels are not just about abstinence. They are really about the sort of idealized man, I guess that's the way to put it, which is what Edward is, loving and respecting his mate enough not to jeopardize her, as he puts it in the novel, virtue until the time is right. Mm. And I think a lot of women have responded to these novels the way that they have because there's something very interesting in this society that encourages young girls to become sexually active as soon as possible about a man who says, no, it's in your best interest for us to wait.
Then on the other hand, for the men, you have Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Here's a scene from an episode. All the characters are under a demon spell, and it compels them to sing and dance.
I touch the fire and it freezes me. I look into it and it's black. Why can't I feel? My skin should crack and peel. I want the fire back.
When did vampires become sexy and heroic as opposed to ghoulish and monstrous?
Vampires were always sexy. There's always been this combination of the erotic and the deadly and the terrifying. I think they perfectly embody Freud's statement about the dual drives in human beings, Eros and Thanatos, by the erotic drive and the death drive. And this is the only monster that brings all of these qualities together. So,
is there another one, too? You know, we live in the Botox age. We're driven by a desire to stay young.
Yes. What it promises you, of course, is immortality. You will be fixed in that youthful state. But alongside of that is, of course, what you mentioned a moment ago, the monstrous aspect of all of this. And you think, how do readers get over the monstrous aspects of this? Well, the erotic is how they get over that, because if you look at the characters in most vampire fiction, they are thinking about the erotic power of this man. And of course, part of what's interesting to me about all of this is that all the traditional definitions of masculinity and femininity are called into question by these novels. You've got images of men who are ineffectual. You've got men who are really not able to stand up to the power of the vampire.